Welcome to the next installment of the SUAS News Podcast Series, where we interview newsmakers and discuss the news and applications relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your program host, Patrick Egan, and as always, let's say hello and a big warm welcome to our co-host, Mr. Gene Robinson. Gene.
Hello, Mr. Egan. Hello. Good to see you. Good to talk to you and happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you. Now, this one has kind of been in the works for a little while. It's a real world flare. And what we're going to do is, as we always like to, we love conversations that talk about real world applications for this technology. And we have our guests today are Randall Warnes from FLIR. Hey, Randall.
Hey, Patrick.
And we have Garrett Brill, who is also using FLIR products for search and rescue and life safety. Hello, Garrett.
Hello, Patrick.
I know you jumped in just a little bit late, but We're gonna move right on, and I would like to today's podcast. Like I said, I really like these podcasts where we get real world experience and people talk about the use cases and whatnot from putting this technology up in the air or whatever they need to do to complete their job. But before we get into the meat of the conversation, maybe we could go around and do some bios. So I think we'll start off with Randall. Randall, could you give us a brief bio about yourself and how you became involved with small unmanned aircraft systems?
Sure. So very brief bio is back in 2014, was a part of one of the first companies in the world to put drones in a brick-and-mortar retail location, opened up 15 locations across North America over 2014 and 2015, and then went on to work for DJI. While at DJI, worked with some of my colleagues in China to set up the foundation of DJI Enterprise, which the Zenmuse XT, thermal imaging integrated camera, was the first product along that line. And so I became very familiar with FLIR as a company and also aerial thermal imaging. And from there, moved on to work for FLIR, where I run their UAS business globally, working with manufacturers, software providers, and large end users or serious end users of this technology, and try to keep an open mind and an open perspective on what could be beneficial for FLIR to enter or add into the drone industry. And obviously, we're the leader in thermal, so that's what brings us to this conversation in search and rescue.
Well, that was a good one. That was pretty concise. You covered a lot of real estate in a short time.
Sure.
So that was good. So you've had a little practice at that one. And Garrett, could you please do the same, sir?
Yes. So my background starts really in aviation with aerospace engineering. And, of course, that naturally goes into whenever the drones came about. Started using those and then shortly after started using them in public safety, using the DJI products with the Joshua Fire Department. And that was back in 2014. From there, kind of progressed forward. And then, as Randall said, that the XT came out on the Inspire 1 platform. And I was lucky enough to be one of the very first users of it. And, of course, it kind of changed everything for us. And from there, we used it as one of the primary imaging systems on just about everything that we could. And from then along came, after that came some of the other FLIR products like the Dual Pro and stuff like that. And now we have the XT2. So I use them mostly for public safety. With the Joshua Fire Department, now we also have the public safety U.S. response team.
That's good. Okay, that sounds good. That's a good. You also covered a lot of real estate there, and people that have listened to the podcast, we're snuggling 350,000 downloads, so they should know Gene Robinson. But for the sake of a background for this podcast, Gene, would it be possible for you to discuss some of your experience with FLIR products and small UAS for search and rescue, firefighting, et cetera?
Sure. I'll try to give you the management summary on this one because, I could go on for a very long time. But, you know, when we started RP Flight Systems, we had the Spectre Flying Wing. And our first encounter with the FLIR product was back in 2008. My partner, business partner at the time, Myron Smorenberg, was in Houston working with Texas Equisearch. And had some FLIR representatives there, some sales representatives, and we really tried hard to dig up their names, but, you know, it's been a lot of history there. But Myron actually did a field incorporation of a FLIR TAU. I think everybody can probably remember the TAU core that was one of the smaller cores that came up there, and he actually flew that TAU core over the killing fields there in Dickinson, which, you know, if you do any research on that one, that's where Tim Miller's daughter ended up being found in that very gruesome serial killing thing there. But he very successfully flew that FLIR TAU over that area, you know, looking just basically to see what we could see because it was in an infancy. And, you know, it was pretty impressive to be able to even – get that from a drone at the time, a civilian drone. And from, you know, there we moved into the search and rescue game. So actually since 2005, we've been doing search and rescue with drones. And, of course, everybody knows that when the XT came out, I, along with Garrett, was lucky enough to get one of the betas, if you will, of that X3 and got to put it through its paces. And very quickly, we managed to get saved. It was along I-35 here in Texas. We had a missing endangered adult, and it was instrumental in us finding that individual. And from there, we've made several more. And it's as Garrett says, this thing has been a game changer for the small unmanned aircraft industry for public safety because, as you know, most of our bad stuff happens at night, and when you have limited visibility and limited vision, what do you got to do? You got to go to a FLIR or a NOG or, you know, something like that. And with the XT, having XT2, now having both the EO and IR, you know, it's a pretty complete package. So I kind of wandered off, and I got away from what I've done in the past, but that's kind of part and parcel to – you know, how we got to where we are today. And we still use our X2 today.
Well, I'm the odd man out here because the only experience I have with FLIR products is the FLIR C-Star Sapphire EOIR sensor. And that's a very robust sensor, but heavier than a small UAS would be, but got a lot of time on that. And yeah, it's funny when the XT came out the first. Yes, sir.
I was going to say you haven't lived yet. You got to try this out.
I know, I do. Because you know, I love the capabilities. I will say, I mean, to say that the thermal imaging is a game changer is almost an understatement because. You know, if you have thermal imaging or you don't have thermal imaging, you know, there's a saying about you should just go home. But if you're in the business of life safety, I mean, it's pretty much from where I stand, it's a must. I did when the first XT came out, and maybe you were there, Randall. Were you there for the kickoff in San Francisco, the little press party?
I was in San Francisco for that launch party, yeah, on December 10th, I believe, 2015.
Yes, and I remember I looked at it and I go, man, you know, it'd be really nice if this had a EO camera on it also. And everybody was like, God, there's no pleasing some people.
Well, sure.
I go, well, you know, I've instructed, you know, ISR teams, blah, blah, blah. And not a lot of people, you know, looking at thermal imagery takes a little bit of doing to get your spatial, let's say, reference without an electro-optical camera. So I was like, you know, well, then you can also blend the pictures and, you know, yada, yada. It goes on and on. But I'm like, I'm just saying, you know, I have a way of, you know, I don't want to go down that road. Anyway, so, but I do believe it's a game changer, especially at the size, price point, and let's say availability I think it's really done some great changes or added some great tools to the, let's say, life safety toolbox. And also, I know, you know, a lot of people use, FLIR sensors or FLIR imaging for industrial applications also. And I do want to touch on that a little bit, too. And maybe we should do that right now, Randall. I mean, I know people are using it for like, roof inspections and energy leaks. And you can look at solar panels and electrical connections. And, you know, I mean, it's like a soup to nuts deal. But maybe you could run over that real quick for us.
Sure. I guess that thermal imaging is relevant in anything where a temperature or the amount of radiation coming off of something is going to determine whether it's functioning normally or not. So with roof inspection, you can see where there's maybe water seeping underneath shingles or a rubber membrane on a roof and be able to determine that there's a problem. Utilities, you can see if the normal operating temperatures are being hit with the process of radiometry. Solar inspection, like you said, a lot of wildlife detection and management. And that kind of leads us into these public safety applications where Garrett has been on, the front end, not only of search and rescue, but also working with firefighting. So we find right now, I would say 60% of the customers of thermal imaging, small UAS is for public safety in some way, shape or form. And a lot of that is going to be looking at hotspots on fires and also for law enforcement agencies doing work looking for people where it's not necessarily a search and rescue mission. But that's where we see largely this technology is being used.
I think you covered it. I mean, really, when you talk about the magic of drones, the thermal imaging part of it is actually, I would say, closer to the magic. It works on a lot of good stuff. A lot of people like to talk about possibilities, and that's really why everyone is on this call today, is because instead of talking about possibilities, we are actually going to talk about the realities. And we'll just run through here, but the thermal imaging, the first thoughts you would share with the potential end user, and we can do life safety, and we'll start with you, Randall. I mean, when someone approaches you and says, hey, is this technology on a small UAS, is this something we should look into? What would you say to life safety people?
Sure. I think that it's a proven lifesaver and property saver when it comes to public safety applications. So it's not a gimmick. It's not like there's a few of these cameras around and we're still testing it. We have been using thermal imaging for search missions on manned aircraft for decades. And we just have miniaturized it and made it more cost effective. And the power of small unmanned systems make it so that you can do these things navigating over rough terrain and over treetops and in the night, in the darkness of night, and be able to locate people without much of an issue. And I think that, as we get to Gene and Garrett, they'll be able to attest that when you are able to hold a controller in your hand or look at a screen, and when you're looking for someone that has been missing or, that you're covering an endless amount of land, having it at the low cost of an unmanned system along with a thermal imaging camera, I don't think there's better technology out there.
All right. Well, yeah, that's a good one. And then Garrett, I know that, so you're working with, the fire department there. And when this all came about, what would you tell people that that ask about this technology?
My first question would be to them, if you don't have one, what are you waiting for? It's as Randall said, it's almost I would consider it almost to the point of being detrimental to your department, or even really putting your firefighters or police officers at undue risk if you don't have something like this, because it is proven. We use it time and time and time again. We use it, in fact, the new combination series like the FLIR Duo Pro and the XT2, it used to be we'd arrive on scene. We had to figure out whether we were going to do, with the XT thermal or we were going to do optical. Now it's not even a question that one of those dual sensors go on there and we're up in the air as soon as we know that we want to have an aircraft in the air, which is pretty much all the time. my fire chief, Wayne Baker, he has been kind of keeping track, and it his numbers show that it saves about 3 hours off of every fire that you use these on. Now, that's potential lives and lots of property. And I do like to bring that up to a lot of people think lives, and that's, of course, the most important, but it does save a lot of property. The other thing that we're seeing here, especially with these latest round of sensors, like I said, the Dual Pro and the XT2, is that they can see things like lasers and flashlights. So I'll give a little scenario that I like to talk about real quick here about how much time I can draw, talk a mental picture here and show you how much time something like this could save. So if there's any firefighters listening, if you take and you have a nighttime wildland fire, as you know, you all go out there and you knock out everything that glows, and then you spend the rest of the night chasing smoke until the sun comes up pretty much. You know, that's pretty much standard operations. Well, you take and you put one of these out there, and let's say you let's take it to the extreme and couple it with a laser, a marking laser, a green laser off of the drone, that you can see that spot in the XT2 or the Dual Pro. So now you locate your hotspots. I like to use isotherm, which is a technology in these units, and you locate your hotspots and you mark that location with a laser. And it now becomes pretty much a laser tag. The firefighters go over there in a brush truck, spray that laser in the surrounding area till it the temperature goes down. You turn the laser off. They know that it's extinguished. You go to the next one, and you knock them all out, do one more pass, and everybody goes home in less than an hour later. So these things pretty much change everything. And you can relate that to police scenarios, too. You know, if you have a suspect that goes hiding in the woods or something like that, it's still difficult for an officer's, you know, if you're trying to bring him into the location via verbal communication, you know, there's a lot of confidence in it that you're telling him left and left is right and right, and you don't get it mixed up. But if you can actually indicate something like that using the thermal imager and show him exactly where it's at, it changes everything. It really, really does.
Well, you know, and another point that you hit on there that makes sense is, you know, you said time. And time is one thing, lives is another thing, but there's also exposure of your equipment and your personnel and safety. More time you're out in the field at night, and let's say, you know, wilderness conditions or fire conditions or even law enforcement conditions or whatever, your people are exposed to injury and your equipment is exposed to damage. So if you can expedite all of those things and move out of the scene and wrap everything up a lot faster, there's a lot less chance for people to get hurt or things to get damaged. That's what I've noticed in the work I've done. Go ahead.
I was going to say what the other thing along those lines is also that, you know, when it rains, it pours, and anybody that's in emergency services knows that. It seems like you might have a little small stint of nice and relaxing time, and then all of a sudden everything breaks loose, you know. And so the faster that you can get your personnel back into being available status, that's a huge benefit. So,
yeah, and ready to refit and redeploy. Absolutely. I agree with that. And so, Gene, you know, I'm going to pose the same question to you. You know, so I know you've been doing this for a long time. You know, so when the question was asked to you, what do you say, you know, about this technology? And
well, I have to echo what both Randall and Garrett say, because in the search and rescue game, our very small motto is minutes matter. So anytime you can reduce the amount of exposure time that your victim has to whatever they're involved in or whatever situation or whatever environment they're in, it could be the difference between life and death. And we've been on several calls where, you know, toddlers have gone out missing and it's a 32 degree night. And, you know, we find them, you know, just before sunup and they're very near hypothermia. And if we hadn't found them, chances are they would have expired. So The minutes matter thing is really important in that particular instance. And one of the things that Garrett said that I will echo is that if you don't have a FLIR, and you don't have the capability of putting a small UAS up like this, you are serving your constituents for half the time. You're bound to serve 24/7, but you can serve them more effectively with that particular sensor because otherwise you're going out blind. You really are. And rekindles, as you know, we've discussed, rekindles on wildland fires will run you buggy trying to get those things done. The FLIR, even the lowest resolution FLIR, can find hot spots in a wide expanse. So, I would have to say, you know, why haven't you done it? I mean, for considerably less than what a lot of other pieces of equipment cost, you can have the ability to be able to see in the dark.
Right.
And then all the other things that you discussed about exposure, liability, being able to refit and be prepared for the next one, all that applies. But again, you know, those are downstream that are all real and they're tangible, but minutes matter.
Right, right. Now, you know, you've used some of the other their other products. I mean, you did some work with NIST on the wildland urban interface stuff.
We did some really cool science with that one. That was with the TASE Duo, and the interesting thing about the TASE Duo is that it did have EO and IR, but the focal length between the two of them were offset, and it was kind of interesting to do that. And we did modify the FLIR. We put some neutral density filters in front of them so that we could expand the temperature range that they would see. But in a matter of 18 months, we collected data that to this day is even still being incorporated into a 3D fire model. So there you go.
It's pretty interesting. Now, I also know, you know, that, and this is for Randall, that FLIR's got some software that is also meant to use with this technology, and there's some new developments. Maybe you could discuss some of that or go into that a little bit.
So I guess it would depend on which software we're speaking about.
Well,
We just put in a minority share investment with a company called DroneSense, and I don't know if that's what you're referring to, or we have our own proprietary software called FLIR Tools and FLIR Tools Plus.
It's actually the proprietary stuff, but we could talk about the new stuff too.
Well, sure. So, I mean, as far as FLIR Tools go, these cameras are on one side, you're able to see an image where you can make determinations about a subject just based off of what, you know, the relative temperature difference between one subject and another. But you can also get radiometric data, which is temperature data, from every pixel within the image. And so we do have software called FLIR Tools, which allows you to manipulate that data to extract more value out of an image post-processing. But that's generally used for things like utility inspections, solar inspections, but not so much with the public safety space. It can be, but I wouldn't see a lot of use there. But as far as the DroneSense stuff, they are a relatively small software company based in Austin, Texas, and focus primarily, or I guess solely, on firefighting applications of UAS technology. And they basically have written software that it's asset management, as well as it's a way that you can replay your flight and show where you were looking at all times. So it allows you to be able to go back, and Garrett has used this and maybe could explain this more firsthand, but you can basically go back through your flight and for documentation purposes show where that flight took place and see where other drones within your group are flying real time. So if you're doing a search and rescue mission, you could see what ground has been covered by which unit real time.
Yeah, and so, yeah, maybe, Garrett, you could expand on that.
Okay, yeah. So the PSERC team here, Public Safety U.S. Response Team, they use the DroneSense for team operations because there's a lot of things that it does really well, and one of them is allows you to fly cooperatively, you know, with other UAS flying in the same vicinity. We've always had the challenge of above ground level altitudes, you know, especially if another guy goes even 100 yards down the road and his he takes off from a lower altitude than you, then you have some serious issues. So this allows us to fly MSL altitude, and you can get all the information from all your wingmen out there that are flying along with you. But they do have the XT and the XT2 implemented very well, arguably even better than DJI on their implementation of it. So it does work very well, and we do use it again mostly for team operations. So.
And you know, so you find the software helpful, you know, and I guess you report back to these people and tell them, you know, what's going on with it. I know, like talking to Gene, you had to develop a lot of different processes for yourself. Are you happy doing it the old school way? Are you looking for software solutions? Have you used this stuff?
Well, you know, I'm forever and ever going to be an alpha geek. So, I'm going to be continually looking for better ways to do things. And I will have to say that since I am pretty near Austin, that we've been involved with DroneSense since they started, actually, and gave them input from the very beginning on that software. So, yeah, we're pretty pleased with the implementation that they've done so far with it. And, you know, Gerard and Chris and the guys out there, we expect a lot from them, and we expect a lot more from them, and they've got a pretty good product.
Well, that's good. Any tools that help in the toolbox, that's a great thing. So, you know, when I'm hearing from everyone here is basically started out as kind of a tool that was added to the toolbox. Now this has become a technology that is a must. Is that a fair assessment of what we've just discussed, Garrett?
Okay, to me, whenever I look at this, the difference that a FLIR unit makes on a drone or a UAS, it basically, what I like to say is it triples your capability. And people are, well, what do you mean by triple? Well, one, obviously, is that now you can extend your operations to night and day, because, I mean, you know, let's be honest, a regular optical camera at night, as Gene pointed out, is not really all that great of a tool. So now you can extend your operations into night. You can see in a spectrum that you couldn't see before. And you can also, if you know how to use the technology or learn how to use the technology properly, it can drastically reduce the time it takes, and this is what Gene was pointing out, the time it takes, both firefighting, police, and search and rescue, all of the above. To me, it doesn't make sense to not have a UAS program and to not have a thermal imaging unit. It doesn't make sense at all. You should either be getting one, budgeting for one, or at least researching it at a minimum.
That's a pretty good testament there, Gene.
I want to say just a little humorous aside there, you know, and it's not the lead up is that there are some humorous things that happen with the FLIR. I can describe a SWAT situation where we had a shooter that was subdued, but they thought that there were others out there, so we were in position and we were on constant contact with two SWAT members and trying to tell them that there was a likely target behind a brick wall and a low brick wall. And as we were talking to them, and it's pitch black for them, and they're going in with their nogs and all that good stuff. And we walk them in 5 meters, 4 meters, 3 meters, 2 meters, you're on top of them, and they're all locked and loaded. And then there's an explosion, and this two or three targets go taken off. And we almost had venison that night because it was a pod of deer that were bedded down together, and it looked for the world like a person back there. But that was pretty good. And one of the things that you never think of, you know, since we started this thing with RP Flight System, Myron and I were actually involved with the body farm there in Texas State University. And we've been flying out there since they had the first volunteer. Well, when we got out there with our X3 and we were looking at various states of decomp, if you will, they were saying, oh, yeah, you don't need to worry about those guys there. They quit putting off heat a long time. And with the radiometric function, we started pinpointing them and said, no, that's not the case according to our instrument. And from that one flight, it changed the way they do business. They now carry handheld thermals to check temperature so that they can get a more accurate read when they quit putting off heat. So, I mean, it just keeps going. And, you know, like I said, it kind of gives you superpowers. It allows you to see in a spectrum that you don't get to see with a normal sensor or the naked eye. So, I mean, it's a tremendous tool. Can't say enough about it.
So it's a must-have.
Tyler, can I throw something out there real quick?
Sure.
Because I do work for FLIR, and I just want anyone that is listening to know that this isn't like – it's not like we said, hey, make sure you say a bunch of great stuff about FLIR technology. I wouldn't want that to sound like this is a sales pitch. But basically, Gene and Garrett going on and saying how great this stuff is, I'm like, I better throw out there that it's not like these guys were like coaxed to doing this. It's the real deal. And if you haven't seen this technology work – see a single video of using isotherm trying to locate a person or locating a hotspot in fire. The videos are out there, and I'm sure Gene and Garrett have a collection of them. But I just wanted to, you know, throw that out there that if you're, you know, rolling your eyes listening to this, you're like, oh, what did FLIR do to get these guys to say? I didn't do anything.
No, this is that's not how we roll here. And that's, you know, I mean, that's
sure.
The difference that we try and do with this podcast is, and I think that's part of the popularity that people listen to this. I mean, you know, and it's like when we try and like, when somebody, you know, people are, oh, you know, do you know any experts, you know, it's like, well, yeah, I know a lot of experts in this field and I try and get them on here. This is unvarnished. You know, these people are talking about, like, both Garrett and Gene are talking about real world stuff here. Or, you know, we wouldn't even waste our time having them on, but there's no coaxing, no plying anyone with liquor or anything. This is the straight stuff. And you know, over the years of doing this, like Gene has talked to me about some of the stuff he's done, like the stuff at the body farm. I mean, it's a little bit, you have to have kind of a strong stomach for it, but a lot of research goes into this, and it's amazing. Like Gene said, it just keeps going and going and going and going. And it just blows me away. And as I had said in the beginning of this podcast, I was really excited about this podcast because we're going to hear a lot of good stuff. And I think we hit pay dirt from about 5 minutes in. And I want to continue with the pay dirt. And Randall, you know, you mentioned an acquisition. And another one I want to talk about is the Black Hornet. And anyone
sure.
that doesn't really know about the Black Hornet is a small UAS, and I first got to see it in Norway, Oslo, in 2014. And you look at this little thing, it's a nano helicopter, and I was like, wow, you know, this is pretty cool. Maybe you could talk a little bit about it, and then we could progress it to some other big news about it.
For sure. So we acquired a company called Prox Dynamics about 2 years ago, and they had the Black Hornet, and now we're at the third variation of that product. But basically, if you want to find a UAS that's nearly silent, nearly invisible to the naked eye, so it can do reconnaissance missions and things of that nature, a whole suite of sensors on board, EOIR, and you know, you're able to get a lot of data with a significant amount of stealth, which is useful for public safety and military applications. So that's what it's focused on. There's not a lot of the other inspection type work that's being done with this technology, but we're really proud of it. The U.S. Army is a big consumer of these nanocopters, and it really just gives a new perspective on how this unmanned technology is being used. And we're really grateful for that team in Norway that put together the business, and now we get to learn a lot of lessons from them as we move forward in other areas of UAS technology.
Well, and I want to talk about it a little bit because I was in Norway, and I interviewed them on a episode of Drone TV while we were there, and it was December in Norway, and he was like, would you like to see it fly? And I'm like, well, you know, yeah, there's, you know, yeah, I want to see it fly. And we go out, and as anyone can imagine, Norway in December is cold, wet, windy, you know, as you would imagine, and, you know, puts it up in the air and the thing flies. And I'm like, wow, because it definitely weighs under 250 grams. I forget what the weight is on it exactly.
I think it's like 5 grams.
Yeah, it's really low. And the thing with it is, I'm like, wow, this thing is flying in the wind? is flying in the rain. Well, it's an actual, this is a real helicopter. It has a swash plate and everything on it. So it can fly in the wind. It can fly in the rain. I was blown away. I was like, wow, you know, can I take this one home for, since we're so close to Christmas? I guess I wasn't good enough. I was still on the naughty list because I didn't get one. But amazing little helicopter. And you're right, Randall. It has, I believe it has three cameras on. It has a forward facing. It's got a thermal, and then it's got a one that points straight down. And it's got a long, it's got tons of capability. It's really great. But then, you know, the other good news I wanted to talk about this is you guys did get a waiver. Can you talk about the waiver a little bit?
Yeah, so early on, as it's a difficult thing to see since it's about the size of the palm of your hand, it by its nature, it's pretty much always flying beyond visual line of sight. So we needed to then find a way to do the demonstrations of this product and then, you know, later on be able to have others use it for its intended purpose. So we were one of the first 14, and I don't know what number was in that first 14, but I can tell you we were in that group. To get a beyond visual line of sight waiver in the United States through the FAA. I think that we had an easier time than some might have because when you're going through this beyond visual line of sight waiver process, you're really talking about risk mitigation. And when you're talking about acceptable risk of a, you know, let's say under 100 gram thing falling and hitting you or going full speed and hitting a person, there's very little damage that could be caused. So if you're able to mitigate risk to that degree, the FAA generally doesn't have too many issues with it. But going through that process, it was a ton of lessons learned. It also increased our interactions with the FAA to position us for bigger things in the future for unmanned systems as well.
Yeah, well, you are correct on that. When it doesn't have to get too far away before it's definitely out of visual line of sight. So that, I guess, was a must-have. The other thing, when you say that, too, and you mitigate risk, if you see one of these in person, it does fit in the palm of your hand. And I'm sure that safety case was probably one of the easier ones to prove. You know, for the FAA to say, hey, you know, there's really low risk here. But yeah, it's a great little system.
With that being said, the amount of testing we had to do to prove it, I mean, it's not just about saying, oh, look, you can't do any damage with it, so just give us a waiver. We went through doing multiple rounds of testing of what is the actual kinetic energy that's, you know, caused by impact going full speed. What's the possible impact or kinetic energy falling from the sky at whatever altitude? So we had to do more science than just say, look, it's obviously safe. And I think anyone that is pursuing a beyond visual line of sight waiver should be ready for putting in the work to make that argument for their system as well.
Right. Although, you know, the terminal velocity of an apple on Sir Isaac Newton's head, it's probably the apple weighs more than the Black Hornet. But, you know,
right.
You got to go through the steps and you have to prove it and everything else. But it's very exciting. It's an exciting technology. It's an exciting piece of equipment, and it is also exciting that you guys got the beyond visual line of sight waiver. And it is kind of expensive, but, you know, our larger law enforcement agencies buying these, or is it primarily military?
I would say that the primary focus is military, but we, because it's a Norwegian company and because they were well established, we sell these things to militaries and law enforcement agencies around the world. And so I don't even think it has to be a large one. It just has to be one that's ready to take on the technology and has use for reconnaissance on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anybody gets to the opportunity to see one, you will be impressed. If you want, you can go to the SUS News YouTube channel and you can look for the Oslo, Norway drone TV episode. The interview's on there. It's pretty interesting. We talk about the capabilities and we actually videoed the flight test. But again, the beyond visual line of sight thing, it disappears rather quickly, but it's still kind of exciting to see. You know, so the other thing I wanted to talk about this too, besides that exciting technology, we pretty much, I think, hit all of the points. Are there, and you know, I know, and I'm running the risk again of sounding like somebody who's never satisfied, Do we have anything new and exciting on the horizon that we can talk about, Randall?
Yeah, so I think that the biggest changes that are being introduced into the thermal imaging world is not necessarily higher resolution or higher functionality, but it's miniaturizing. It's taking less weight and it's taking less to power it. So with the Boson core, we've been using Tau 2 cores for 10 years on many of our products, including the UAS products. And I think that it would be reasonable to say that most things will be based off the Boson, which is, I would say, a sixth of the size and maybe a tenth of the weight, and a significant amount less of power consumption. So for a UAS application, all of those things are extremely important for flight time, and as well as just capability of getting a payload on. So we don't have anything that's like we're putting out tomorrow or we're announcing here, but we are working on technology that will be much more suitable for a wider number of UAS platforms because of that reduction in size and weight, as well as just significant to the flight time.
Well, and those are all good things to strive for, because like you said, you want a lighter, less power consumption, more time in the air, more usability. Garrett, any wish list? Or are you happier than a clam with what you got?
Oh, don't ask me for a wish list, because I'm one of those guys to discuss. What did Gene say? What did he call himself? An alpha geek. Gene, I'm stealing that, man. I'm an alpha geek, too, and it could go on forever. I could see things like I'll give you an example of just one thing. If you're going to put something on my wish list, probably the only way that I know of without knowing anything better would be, you get something like a FLIR Duo Pro or X-T2, and then you add zoom capabilities to it as well, to where you truly have a pretty much all-in-one payload that you can put on there and have every, because, right now, X-T2 or FLIR Duo Pro, you put it on there, but there are some times where you need to verify, hey, this looks like it could be a body part, or it looks like it could be, a shirt, or the color of the shirt, and you either have a zoom camera to verify that, or you send in one of the guys on the ground to verify what you're seeing. Something like that. Of course, FLIR makes magic happen, is what I always say. And so, who knows what they'll come out with and allow us to see it. There's also on the fire side, more of the hazmat side, there's been a lot of guys asking for something that could see, gases or something like that. The hazmat guys are kind of like your SWAT team and the police. Your hazmat guys, they have their very specialized stuff, and they want to be able to see, detect gases or fumes and stuff like that. So of the short wish list off the top of my head, that's probably the things that I can come up with.
And I could see us really getting there. The technology is really changing for size and miniaturization and what we can fly and all the rest of that. And I know FLIR does offer some different focal length lenses. That's correct, right, Randall?
Yeah, I guess that for different applications require different field of views or amount of pixels you can get on the target from a distance that you want to fly from that target. So we try to give a variation, but there are some limitations to the technology as far as the number of pixels we can get into a uncooled core, which we're working on for Gene and Garrett and public safety alike, but we're still a ways away.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to seeing how this progresses. We've seen a lot of changes in the last couple of years, and you're talking about some new technologies with the new sensor and things. I think we're going to get there. And I'm really excited that we got to do this podcast. I learned a lot. The technology is great. And I think it's going to really progress in the next couple of years. And I want to thank everyone for
having me. Hey, you didn't ask the Alpha Geek what's on his wish list.
Oh,
well, that's because I figured this one's going to be long. But go ahead. You give us one of your wishes, and maybe,
one wish is going to be the Star Trek tricorder on a drone. That's it. That's it.
How about some cloaking technology? You want some of that too?
No, we can, that's Klingon stuff. We'll use Federation stuff. Just the tricorder is good for right now. But I could go on. You just only give me one. So there you go.
That's a good one. I like it. All right, I'm going to work on that. I'm going down to the basement now. Anyway, I want to thank you gentlemen for coming on. That was a fantastic podcast. As always, it's great to have experts on and learn. So thank all of you for being on, and everyone for listening. Until next week or the next episode, you know, have a good one.
Thanks, Patrick. Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, guys.